Hey folks, welcome back to The Ferment. My name is Marcus Peter Rempel. It's good to have you back. Good to have you back and around for a conversation between Sam Ewell and David Cayley. Getting into the sometimes thorny, I think, conversation about Christian mission. Christian mission. The idea of the missionary has become tainted, probably in many of our minds, and Illich for me is someone who has helped redeem that word, not least because he is very clear and very critical about how mission can go profoundly awry. When it comes from a place of control and power, or the seeking after control and power over other people. The image that always sticks with me that I gained from Illich is of the razor's edge that the Christian walks between violating the world into which one has been sent. He actually uses the word raping the world into which one has been sent. Or, on the other side, betraying one's own spiritual inheritance. I fall off of either side of that divide plenty of times. Probably spend very little time in the on the balance point, and a lot of time in the ditch on either side. But I'm grateful for the image and for the challenge. And I'm grateful for your interest in this conversation. So if you like what's happening here at The Ferment, you want to chip in, you can find us at Patreon. There's links at theferment.ca if you want to go there. And also all podcasters in their mission to gain ears and probably, if we're honest about it, converts of some sort or another. It all begins with likes on the internet, or it seems to anyway these days. So I think it does help certain algorithms put people of like mind in touch with each other. So if you want to like us on whatever podcast app that you find us on at Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever, that helps too. I think that's all the housekeeping for today. So without further ado, I give you a conversation about Christian mission and other matters between David Cayley and Sam Ewell, hosted by myself and David Benjamin Blower. Peace.
All right, folks. Well, I'm going to begin us and introduce us. My name's David Benjamin Blower. And this has been partly started by my friend Marcus Rempel, who will also be guiding us through the evening. This set of discussions has grown out of a small group of friends, a reading group, who were gathering around David Cayley's recent book, Ivan Illich, An Intellectual Journey. And they very, very generously opened up their table to include all of us other folks. So much gratitude to them. So our discussion this evening will be between David Cayley and Sam Ewell. David Cayley was on our call 2 weeks ago talking to Dougal Hine. David's an old friend and associate of Ivan Illich, the author of several transcripted conversations with Illich, of which Rivers North of the Future has been a very influential book on me and others, and recently has published his book, Ivan Illich, An Intellectual Journey. David will be speaking this evening with Sam Yule. Sam is a gardener and a theologian. He's the author of Faith Seeking Conviviality. It's a beautiful book of his reflections on Ivan Illich as he thought through his own vocation within the question of mission, particularly as he was spending years living with his family in Brazil. All right, I'll hand over to you here, Marcus.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks all for being here. I've kind of seeded some themes that I'm hoping that David and Sam will get into. They're going to mostly improvise a conversation. I thought I might just to get things rolling in conversation with David Benjamin. We were thinking about, how can we make this conversation land in some way with some of the really pressing current events. And I found this quote in Sam's book that I think is maybe a helpful jumping off place. This is in regards to living with an awareness of what Illich calls professional power, by which he means the power to prescribe. So without this awareness, we succumb to a political process that turns citizens into impotent clients who must be contained within the military, industrial, professional complex in order to be saved by armies, machines, and experts. So I wonder if to begin our evening or our afternoon, depending on where we are, if each of you, David and Sam, could take a crack at this question. As we witness atrocities in Israel and Gaza, the grind of brutal war in Ukraine, and really it feels like we're teetering on the brink of what could be a global conflagration, how might Illich encourage us to exercise an active freedom as citizens rather than falling into the impotence of clients who are at the mercy of what he thought of as the military industrial professional complex? Just something light to get us started.
Thank you, Marcus. Okay. Are you looking to me? Because I would understood that Sam would begin, but I'm rather daunted
Yeah,
by what
well, let's start with Sam. It was a quote
I'm
from
rather
his book.
daunted by what you just proposed. He's a professional speaker. I'm an ex-professional
Oh,
speaker.
oh. Okay, so is the ball with me then? It's
That's with you, Sam.
Thank you.
God bless you.
I'm playing the old man card, Sam.
Right. I was gonna defer, but okay. Thank you for hosting, Marcus. Thank you to all of you for being here and in the space. And thank you for yes, throwing us in the deep end right from the get-go. I think just to approach that, perhaps to pick up on a theme that really surfaced also in the first conversation. I think, if you zoom out, which that question invites us to zoom out, one of the things that Illich really brought into view was professional power, I think the dominance of institutions and that phrase, military, industrial, professional complex. And that can sound when you just hear that term, and I won't try to rehearse all of Illich's critique, but just to kind of try to zoom back in to say that one of the things Illich brought to our attention, one of the things he did, I call it his prophetic imagination. And I'm using that as a riff on, if you're familiar with the work of Walter Brueggemann, his reading of the prophets in Israel, he talked about the prophetic imagination always works as a double-edged sword. One aspect of the prophetic imagination is the work of what he called dismantling. That's the work of being the iconoclast, of saying that certain institutional forms are the sites, not so much of freedom, but the crucible of a power, of a dependence, you know. And, you know, I think it was Eisenhower that actually coined the term the military industrial complex, but Illich saw that as the ways that it disabled the activity of citizens. So the prophetic imagination, or what I'm calling the prophetic imagination of Illich, one aspect was to say, we've kind of imagined institutions as, and those social forms as being our liberators. But then we also, we become aware that if we don't maintain a critical distance, how they disable our activity. They leave us impotent. We can only act as consumers of their products and services. So one aspect is the dismantling. But I also wanted to hit the note, the other aspect of prophetic imagination. So in the same way that you would have a Jeremiah critiquing a certain kind of corrupt form of alliance between nations, or a religious form of power that's manifest idolatry, that kind of biblical imagination of dismantling, there's also the other aspect is the energizing. That's the note of hope, of the kind of alternative consciousness. So yeah, it's all in Illich. I guess what I would just say, what I kind of took from him, and this one entry point, a theological entry point, is that that gospel narrative of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10 that we mentioned, and the power of, you can imagine in that context, you have a Samaritan and a Jew who's, you know, the wounded one on the road to Jericho, but just within a kind of institutional imagination or religious imagination, there was a boundary there. There was a kind of captivity, or there's an impotence to respond to the other. Illich's reading of the Good Samaritan and that energizing aspect was to highlight how radical it was that the Samaritan, the Palestinian, as he also referred to him, crossed the road, did not pass by on the other side, did not remain contained by a kind of institutional religious imagination, but transgressed it, crossed the road, and enacted an encounter. I love the slide. You posted this theme of neighborliness at the end of Progress. And I think that's to me, a wonderful place to zoom in on the energizing aspect of Illich's imagination. Today's gospel was about love of God and love of neighbor in the lectionary. And Illich is saying, you know, if you were a good Jew, you knew that there was a call to love your neighbor. And it's that radicality of the parable of the Good Samaritan is the invitation not to draw a line or a box around neighbor, not to draw a line in a kind of institutionalization to say, there's a we here that contains me, and I can only see them as an enemy or someone that I can't possibly respond to. So going back to the energizing aspect, and this, what one of the things that I've learned from Illich is, the question is, are you willing? Are you willing to respond, to not be contained, to not pass by on the other side, to cross the threshold? And I think that opens up at both the neighborly, it's as micro as the street you're walking down and not passing by on the other side, how you inhabit your neighborhood, those human scale relationships. And it's as macro as how you can reimagine in a kind of geopolitical way, belonging that begins with that imagination that Jesus opens up a new we. So I think maybe I'll kick it to David now to see if you can, David, if you want to riff on any of that.
Well, a word that struck me in what you said is lines, because I feel like in the last 2 to 3 weeks, I can't remember exactly how long it's been, I feel like I've been in a storm of discourse, which has all been challenging me or taunting me to take a side, that I must have a side, that I can't see all the people involved here, because I got to choose which side I'm on. This is it. So it seems like it's the kind of Girardian original situation right before my eyes in microcosm, right? I'm watching sin being washed away in the blood of the other before my eyes. So I don't know what Ivan would say. I think the poor man should probably be left in peace. Maybe one remark to remember, just to begin, was a story that's told in The Rivers North of the Future. He related to me a conversation with Romano Prodi, who was the brother of his dear friend Paolo, but then also the Prime Minister of Italy, who approached him after a lecture and said, "Is what you've said tonight a continuation of prophecy for our time?" Ivan said, "Well, no, not prophecy. I disclaim that word because I think the vocation that belongs to us after the incarnation is the vocation of friendship, not of prophet." Now, prophet is a word with a big range, and you can't tell people what they ought to mean by their words. You have to try and find out what they do mean. And there's certainly a large part of what people call prophecy, which pertains to Illich. But I still take him seriously, and I wouldn't accordingly call him a prophet, because I think he's saying something to us. And one of the things he's saying is that he can't probably be of much help at this moment, right? That this is amongst us, it's between us. It's a matter for friends to sort out now. So I don't know if that's an acceptable beginning.
I like that. And I think I just want to maybe converge that notion of what I was describing as his prophetic imagination, which is kind of just a way of holding together that dismantling and the energizing, but to bring it back to friendship, which is such a key word for Illich. I'll tell it this way. And because, you know, I mean, I think on our mind, everyone, I think, is probably one of the things that's been brought into view. If you kind of zoom out geopolitically, is the conflict, the war in Gaza and Israel. And again, not to start the entry point on what side are you on, but just to get it back through the lens of friendship. I was in struggling to find a way to respond. I reached out. I just want to tell this story because I think this is a kind of Illichian imagination that led me to this. But I reached out to my friend here, Rabia Latif, who may or may not be on this call, but she's a close friend, practicing Muslim, you know, a woman of prayer and faith. And we found ourselves connecting about a week after the conflict kind of escalated. And, you know, so there've been gatherings, maybe where you live too, there've been, you know, protests in March and that kind of thing, and calls for ceasefire. But one of the things that Rabia pulled it back, because we were talking about our own friendship and who do we know and how we gather. And she actually works for an organization called Near Neighbors, which the whole fits with this theme. And Near Neighbors is about bringing people together, not only in interfaith, but across lines of difference, bringing people together to do things together. And she said, Sam, what if we, alongside the other things that are being organized, if we organize in our friendship networks, our leadership networks? So she's reached out to the Reformed Synagogue here, to two mosques that she has relationships. And I've started with my priest at the Catholic Church, other Christian networks. And so leading up to Interfaith Week, we want to have a conversation and make it about solidarity, make it about compassion, these kinds of things. But I just wanted to say, I think there is a, yes, I don't think turning to Illich in this moment is a pull off the shelf answer, but it is to say it also has to be, it's about encounter. And I just want to draw a connection here between Illich's emphasis on the turn to the neighbor, the vocation to prolong the incarnation, that fleshly encounter with the other. And you know, Pope Francis has written a number of encyclicals. One of them, if you're familiar with this, it's the title in Latin is Fratelli Tutti, brothers all, or brothers and sisters all. But he has this lovely turn of phrase to me that really lands with this emphasis on friendship. He calls it a culture of encounter, because again, we've been socialized within these complexes to think we have to choose sides, or we have to kind of have an institutional or a national allegiance, and that our borders, those borders and lines, are infallible and non-transgressible. Where going back to the Samaritan, Pope Francis uses the parable of the Good Samaritan to talk about threshold, this threshold of encounter and the invitation. He talks about neighbors without borders, which I think to me is just a way of opening up that invitation to friendship in a way that also can open up new possibilities, new forms of belonging, where we're no longer trapped in the we versus them. A culture encounter, I think, is just one thing that I'm holding in light of Illich and also of Pope Francis.
Yeah, but amen.
I mean,
can I throw another question?
Of course.
I'm excited today to be like have a conversation with someone who is a missionary and to bring this conversation of Christian mission. And as you're talking about this wonderful gift that we have in Jesus' invitation to see the neighbor beyond the border, I'd love for you to talk about both the shadow of that, that in Christian mission, like where Christian mission can become this thing that transgresses boundaries violently, right? What you've learned and unlearned from Illich about the meaning of Christian mission as you continue to riff here.
Thanks, Marcus. Again, I was introduced to Illich. I tell this story in the beginning of my book, and I may read an excerpt, but just to set that up, I was actually introduced to Illich through a friend, which is very appropriate. A guy named Claudio Oliver. This was around 2007. And we had been, just to set the stage also around missionary, I'm a U.S. national. I married Rosalie Veloso, who's Brazilian. We met in the States, studied theology in the States. In 2003, we moved to Brazil. And we were sent as missionaries by a lovely African-American congregation that received us, which is another kind of border crossing in of itself. But anyway, we were sent to Brazil as missionaries to share the peace that we had received from them. That was how they commissioned us in the spirit of John 20. And when we arrived there, so 2003, what I learned is that on the one hand, yes, we had a sense of vocation. Now, that vocation was also tied up in that that already that encounter, you know, with Rosalie, our vows were from the book of Ruth. Your people will be my people. Our wedding vows were taken from the book of Ruth. So there was this sense mission for us was not, it wasn't, again, a pull off the shelf sense of we were working with this missing agency to do X, Y, and Z. It was more of a, there was a deep sense of vocation and call and being sent. Now, fast forward 3 or 4 years in Brazil, what I had learned is, and this is, there's a complex, there's an institutional complex that was shaping my imagination and also shaping the expectations of others. So around power, around being a white male American in Brazil is about, it represents, there's an imaginary around, you're the helper, you're the one who delivers projects and money too. I think there's a strong expectation from the Brazilian side. This was all, I don't know that I could have articulated it like that. It was in 2007, I meet Claudio. He, in the course of conversation, he tells me he's doing research on Paulo Freire and Ivan Illich and Tolstoy, if I remember. And I said, Illich? Now I know the other two, but who's this Illich guy? And I'd never heard of Illich. And he couldn't believe that I hadn't heard of Illich and that I'd studied theology at Duke. And he really laid into me like, man, I can't believe you haven't heard of Illich. He sends me a link to this talk that Illich gave in 1968 called To Hell with Good Intentions. And Claudio said, I think as a friend, this would be a good word for you. And basically Illich says that, I mean, the kind of says what it does what it says on the tin. To Hell with Good Intentions, Illich was based in, he gave this talk in 1968 to, I guess you'd call like gap year exchange students and people who were having a kind of an immersion experience in Mexico, where he had this center of intercultural formation. And he gave this talk to, you know, he basically says, you've come here. It's almost in your DNA as Americans, or North Americans, to be benevolent, to want to do the good. But what makes you think that just by arriving, you're going to know the codes, you know the presence, to know how to cross a threshold, this kind of thing? And he really throws down the gauntlet. And he ends this talk by saying, come to learn. I'm paraphrasing only slightly. He says, come to learn Spanish. Come to learn the songs, come to walk in the hills, come to learn to be with people, but please do not come to help, full stop. That's how he ends it, right? And I remember thinking then, it was a kind of converting moment where I thought, you know, either Illich is just really kind of grumpy and is just kind of angry about this influx of North Americans, or he sees something deeper, beyond a presence that's more creative and more subversive than just being cast in the role of helper. That began the unlearning, Marcus, that you asked about. And that began a journey. So if I could just read this little passage, and then maybe David can respond, because I know you've had perhaps a similar experience or awareness yourself, David. But this is what I wrote about that encounter and the journey of encountering Illich, of reading the To Hell with Good Intentions. Fundamentally, the insight of Illich's message challenged my burdensome temptation to fix all that was wrong with Brazil by playing the role or being cast in the role of do-gooder. At the same time, the more I read Illich, the more I realized he was not letting do-gooders like me off the hook. Reading him closely, I understood he was not advocating disengagement as an antidote to do-gooderism, but rather a different kind of presence, a more aware, a more subversive presence. I realized that if I were going to take Illich as my guide, I was going to have to question not only my intentions and actions, but also, here's the zoom out, the arena in which Christian witness has unfolded in Brazil. More generally, I realized that by taking Illich as my guide, I would have to question the certainties and the assumptions that shape the way Christians imagine their place and role in relation to God's good intentions for the whole world. More than anyone else, Illich has influenced me by naming the air I breathe as a missionary, by navigating a similar path in the Americas that I was to embark on as a disciple, by inspiring me to embrace both the truth that comes to us in Jesus, that's Ephesians 4:21, and the world that has come upon us. More than anyone else, Illich offered me a way of not suppressing the questions and epistemological ruptures that came with being a missionary, but he also gave me a way of integrating them towards the renewal of my own theological imagination. In other words, I encountered Illich as someone who was not just informing me about the air I breathe and its effect on me, as a doctor might inform a patient, but as someone who was witnessing to me as a friend, guiding and accompanying other on a journey while enabling me to become a witness myself. So I've written this book then as a form of witness, an extended testimony that is at the same time an exercise in doing theology with and after Illich. So, there's a before and after for me. There's a before and after. And I think just without naming every question and certainty, I think it is very much that Illich kind of took an x-ray. I don't know if that's the right metaphor, but there was a light in Illich that exposed the way a kind of social dominance, form of power, a missionary complex of do-gooderism. I describe myself now as, in relation to Illich, I mean, in this context, as a recovering do-gooder, in the same way someone might describe themselves as a recovering alcoholic, in the sense of, there is the invitation in Christian mission to, when we join with God's renewal of all creation, to do the good, to respond, to embrace, to, you know, to touch, to heal. Do-gooderism is, I think, that's the corruption. That's when power, that's the imposition, and it's the distortion of the encounter. And Illich, that was what Illich was both dismantling and energizing me to a different kind of presence.
Over to me, I'm thinking. It's interesting, Sam, that this very same lecture, we can talk about this later if you want, which I believe was given in Chicago, not in Cuernavaca, to a group of CS volunteers who were bound for Mexico, was also the first thing I ever encountered of Illich's in 1968, after I had been 2 years with an organization called the Canadian University Service Overseas, a development agency, not a missionary organization, if there's a difference. But it's interesting that we had the same, and it was, I thought, okay, now I'm beginning to be able to reflect on what has happened, and was the beginning of a long journey. About mission, Marcus, I mean, I recall in a very early piece of writing by Ivan called The American Parish, he says that mission is simply a Christian vocation. You couldn't be a Christian if you didn't want to share the good news, then you wouldn't be a Christian. It wouldn't evidently have been good news to you. So I found that an interesting remark, and obviously it was forgotten as Ivan was vilified within the church, that his opposition to certain kinds of American missionary activity must be an opposition to mission itself. And he tried to think it through in a number of writings that have been published in this book that came out in 2018, I think, Powerless Church from the Penn State Press, which has a lot of those writings and is well worth reading. So he tried to think how Christians could be missionaries without in all the established senses of the word, actually being missionaries, what Sam was trying to unlearn, the desire and the deep feeling that one was called to help. So that's the first thing. To go back to what you broached at the beginning, Illich himself was never a missionary, and he was actually a critical intellectual. That was his primary vocation, in my opinion. And I'm becoming more preoccupied with this as I grow older, but I think when you were asking that question, I thought of Theodor Adorno, somebody who, a German philosopher, died a long time ago, who had nothing that I know of to do with Illich, but he was attacked in Germany in the later 60s by the New Left because he wasn't doing anything. He was accused of resignation. And he wrote a wonderful response to his student tormentors, amongst I might well have been myself at that time, but I side with Adorno now, saying that thinking was a joy and a necessity, even when what one had to think about wasn't necessarily pleasant or what one would like to think about. So I resonate with that and think that there surely isn't a great deal we can do about things that are conceived in terms which we reject. So, as I said at the beginning, one is invited to take a position and the terms presented are unacceptable terms. And, you know, I mean, the gist of the Christian story is finally crucifixion, which I sincerely hope to avoid, but is the final step clearly on that road of refusal to engage on unacceptable terms, of saying no to this way of the world. So this, I don't know where this is going, but I am increasingly preoccupied in writing about the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, where I worked most of my life, and on which I'm trying to finish a book. But it could be almost anything else. Is our projects, I would say, of retrieval, of recuperation. I mean, the CBC, for example, has completely renounced Canadian history. Well, a country without a history is a country without a future, in my opinion, by definition. But it's also renounced critical thinking and increasingly embraced a kind of a cheerleading, acclamation, an overwhelming sense of we, set against a them who justifies everything that the we thinks and does, because the them are so terrible. Most of my emphasis is in this hope of retrieval, of going back. I don't think there's a great deal to be done about a lot of what confronts us, but there is perhaps something to be done about how we name it, how we think about it, and in that sense, how we respond to it. So that's probably where my main emphasis is.
Yeah, man. I appreciate that when you made this connection with retrieval. I think one of the things that really, there's another word there. You know, Illich talks about convivial recovery. There's Illich, the historian, where he talks about looking at the present in the mirror of the past. And that Illich, the social critic, talks about recovery was one of his keywords. And I think maybe just also to kind of connect and lean into a story for those that haven't necessarily read all of Illich, but tell it a story that brings this to light. This is another story about encounter with Claudio, the very person who introduced me to Illich. Another turning point, there's a Portuguese word, virada, that I talk about. It's a turning point, but it's a kind of converting, you know, a kind of fork in the road where you make a certain turn from a certain path, or to think in Romans 12, you know, you break with a certain pattern. The second time that I met Claudio, and I want to connect to this idea of convivial recovery, to Illich's distinctions between nouns and verbs. So when inside that military industrial professional complex, one of the things that happens is that Illich says, we come to, as citizens, we're almost reduced to consumers of nouns. By nouns, he means commodities, like services, products, and we lose the verbs, the activity. As an example, you know, he says, even in our language, it's shifted over industrialization. We say, I get an education. Education is now a noun. It's something that I have to access an institution and a certain institutional process to get an education. But people have always learned, and just, you know, learning is a verb. So of course you can learn inside of an institutional context, but I think that it's that distinction about recovering verbs, you know, that's important. When I met Claudio in Brazil, it was a powerful example of this, the industrial versus the convivial thing that Claudio, I saw him trying to retrieve, actually reimagine my understanding of presence there. He was on the fifth floor of his balcony in a tower block in Curitiba, city about the size of Birmingham, 1 to 2 million. And he was kept going to his garden, his balcony, where he had a vertical garden on this balcony. And he kept making these little trips from his kitchen. And I was curious, I went out there. He had a wormery, so he was composting all of his food scraps, right? See a few heads nodding. Maybe we have a few composters on the call. But he was composting with worms and small spaces. He had this, it was just teeming with life in this small space. And I remember asking him all these technical questions. My first degree was in biology, you know, asking all these how questions. And he kind of interrupted me. And I remember him saying, Sam, how's easy, man? I mean, you could go on YouTube, you know, there's lots of videos, man, how's easy? The real question is why? Why would you do this? Why am I doing this when I could just put it in the bin? And he said, dealing with your food scraps at home is one of the most creative and subversive things that you can do in your house. And I thought, man, he just deeped it. I thought we were just talking about a vertical garden. Right. And then he picks up, this is the show and tell moment tonight. He picks up a banana peel out of the little compost area. And he says, in our tradition, this is your retrieval, in our tradition, the narrative goes, in the beginning, God created and said it was good. Who authorized us to call it lixo? Who authorized us to call it rubbish, garbage? And then he says to me, if you take care of your food scraps at home and treat creation like creation, it will never be rubbish again. That's why it's subversive. And I tell that story because in that moment, that was another kind of rupture, another kind of, I realized I'll never, right then, I was being invited to see creation as creation and to treat creation as creation, which implies a verb. The industrial solution to banana peels and the scraps on our plate is to call it rubbish and to throw it away. The convivial solution or the convivial response is to see it as part of, it's just, people have always had food scraps and everyone has them. But going back to retrieval, our grandparents, I still remember my grandparents, nothing was wasted. There was no rubbish. It was just part of a cycle. It went to an animal or it went into the ground. And I just mentioned that as one of to me, that narrative kind of holds a lot, because in terms of Illich, it is about the recovery of a verb. Composting is a convivial process. It requires care, touch, attention. Food waste management is an industrial process. They're two very different things. And you might ask yourself, but Sam, how is this going to change the world? How's it going to do this? And this is the other thing I learned from Illich. By itself, you know, Claude Joux composting on his balcony doesn't change the world. But what he learned from Illich and what he taught me was what Illich called gratuity. And, you know, it doesn't, we have this word in English, gratuity, but the old sense of gratuity, an act is gratuitous. You do it freely because it's good, true, or beautiful. It's fitting. It's fitting. It's fitting if your narrative of the world is that in the beginning, God created and said it's good. It's fitting that you compost this. It's not fitting to throw it away, right? So it's a fitting act. And you do it because it's good, true, or beautiful, not because of some, you're trying to corral an effect. And I'll just finish with this. And I just wonder, maybe you have a response to that. Now in Curitiba, because of Claudio and his community was doing this, the city municipality is rolling out the wormeries. And there is a program about trying to, how do we roll out composting because of what they did. And our city of Birmingham is running a food waste pilot. Here, if you're in the England, UK context, what we hear from public health is that the goal, you will have to separate what they would call food waste from rubbish by the end of 2024. This is going to be a national policy shift. So there's your macro industrial machinery in place, but there's nothing in place. So in Birmingham, where we live, so they're looking for responses. We're actually doing this with our neighbors, and we called the pilot who said this is rubbish.
If I'm remembering rightly, the section of Tools for Conviviality that you're quoting about recovery lays out specifically three conditions for recovery. Mm-hmm. And the first of them is to overcome the delusion about science. The second is to regain a connection to one's own words, to recover the ability to speak in a personal and original way. And the third was the recovery of law, so that legal procedure would be put back in people's hands. And people thought he was a bit of a dreamer about the common law, but it doesn't matter. That was the third condition. But that more or less illustrates what I was trying to talk about earlier. And if you think about overcoming the delusion about science, he doesn't say overcoming science. He says overcoming the sense that that knowledge is the product of an institution, that it's a staple. It's available. You can identify it by its functionaries. They'll be wearing white coats or whatever. And I mean, I think we've lapsed now into what one fears is a terminal condition. I mean, when people can speak as they did in Canada during the last three years, going on four, one is frightened to say, about how they were all following science as if this were some great oracle or some great monolith or some Baal that spoke. It's just remarkable, and it illustrates how far away we are from the moment which Ivan thought this was might be a practical proposal. One, I think, can say the same thing about language, the willingness to pass on damaged words, useless, inane words, words that have been bent to somebody else's purposes long before they ever issue from your mouth, and with which you can't say anything, because something in effect is saying you, is equally has gone a long way farther down the road since Ivan wrote about it in 1973. So these would be examples of what needs to be retrieved. I think that's ongoing. It was maybe worse now than when Ivan spoke, but it isn't. It's never over, or at least it's not over till it's over, as Yogi Berra said, and it's not over yet. So yeah, that's sort of what I meant by retrieval, and those are the kind of critical projects that one can carry out without necessarily knowing how to intervene in something that's misdefined, misaligned, which in a certain way one can only suffer and try and hope in the midst of it, but it can't be corrected in its own terms, because its terms are why it exists in the first place. That's what it is. So
yeah, there's so much there. And you know, I'm also just thinking, I began my encounter with Illich happened in Brazil, and in fact, the short answer for how we got, we're now based in Birmingham, UK, and have been for 12 years. Our family came here in large part for me to do a PhD that I did the academic research around Illich, but it was very much provoked by these lived questions, encounters with Illich, encounters with friends, this kind of thing. And I think it's also just, you know, Marcus invited us to, because of that narrative, I think the mission was one word. It's really interesting how I'm aware how much I use, my point here is not to defend or to cancel the word mission. I think I'm always careful in a particular context to talk about, depending on who I'm talking to, I think it's, you know, as a shorthand, mission might just be, it might be useful to think about, it's how we participate in God's good intentions for the world, you know, as God's people. There's different ways, but not so much as an institutional delivery of a certain technique or program, which that would be, I think, veering into that institutional dominance and perhaps a kind of corruption of a presence. Landing in here in England, you know, and finishing the PhD, it was very much, you know, I remember writing and saying, this was not I didn't write a theology of Ivan Illich. I don't know that I'd be capable of writing that, you know, a theology of, but it was about trying to imagine with and after Illich. And that after for me, you know, it's just been really interesting. And I just wanted to connect it up with that first slide that was here, and maybe Marcus or David wants to take it in a certain direction, neighborliness at the end of progress. I think one institutional temptation, I mean, if you find yourselves in gathered church or an institutional form, is to kind of despair about institutional decline. And then your energy and imagination is very much around trying to shore up, you know, find the perfect program. How do we attract people into our church and this kind of thing? And I'm not here to junk that. It's just to say that Illich, it's one of the things that I learned from Illich was trying to have a wider frame of vision. And then it's this turn to, instead of just trying to think about the institutional form and its performance as the horizon in which you see everything, reimagining this invitation to neighborliness as a kind of baseline. Or one way we might say this, you know, when we arrived here, finishing the PhD, we ended up moving to a neighborhood. We were in student housing for a while. Then we moving to another neighborhood where we've lived for the last 7 or 8 years. And And it happened to be there was another family that was in a transition at the same time. And we connected with them. And I just remember saying, very much inspired by Illich and the kinds of things we've talked about, that I said, you know, in Brazil, so much of my imagination was around trying to do church or kind of get people to church. And it was in that particular context, you know, a kind of institutional performance, not in a manipulative way even, but in a sense of that was where my imagination was at a certain time. And I said to my wife and meeting and kind of praying with this other family, what if the name of the game is not just kind of how we either start or find the perfect, you know, institution, but if we reimagine what it means to be the body of Christ, neighbors with our neighbors. So I think it was this turn to the neighborhood was one thing, you know, being a Christian presence in, with, and for our place, in the sense of this is human scale relationship that we want to. And so we came up with this strap line, being neighbors on purpose. We actually, because of my visa status, there was a pragmatic aspect. I couldn't just be Johnny Freelance. We had to have a kind of structure to it. So I would say Companions for Hope is a hybrid. It's on the one hand, a kind of lo-fi organization, you know, institution. It's very kind of light touch, but it, I mean, it does have processes and all that. But it's also what I describe at the end of the book. So it's what I would call a kind of ecumenical based community. It's not allergic to institutional forms, but it tries to the strapline of being neighbors on purpose. So David, if you and I live on the same street or happen to have the same postcode, as we'd say here, we're neighbors by accident. That's just circumstance. The real question is, what would it mean to be neighbors on purpose? And I mean, I could describe a few of those experiments, but I just want, it was that turn towards neighborly, being the neighbor. And we actually have, we're coming up the first Wednesday of every month, we have neighbor nights. This is just an example, but this has been going since 2017, before COVID. It's a space where anyone can come together. We share food. So it's a kind of bring and share or potluck, and neighbors come together to propose. So we say often, if you want to rant, there's a place for that, but you go to the ward forum with your counselors to rant. That's the energy of that space. If you want to rant about litter, go to the ward forum. If you want to propose a litter pick or organize neighbors to do something with you, come to neighbor nights and propose it. And I'm just mentioning that as, I don't know if that resonates with you, I think, but it's this intentionality and maybe even to say, is there, as we imagine what it's like to cross thresholds, I don't walk around saying I'm a missionary. That's too loaded. It doesn't help.
No, it wouldn't.
Right? But I'm always invitational about saying to my neighbors, whether they're Christian, of no faith, Muslim, Sikh, and it's a super diverse area, what does it look like for us to be neighbors on purpose? And I wonder if we become aware of the corruption of a Christian mission, a Christian witness, that tries to instrumentalize the neighbor, to kind of impose or bring the neighbor in a kind of colonizing or manipulative way. And we recognize the fallout of that. And can part of that future, can we say, both theologically, but also just at a pragmatic level, what that's not universalizable, that project failed. But what may be universalizable is the vocation to be the neighbor and to lean into that.
I wonder. Yes, somebody else is clearing their throat. Is that you, Marcus?
Oh, I think. Well, we're at the 4 o'clock mark, so I think David's going to open the floor for questions now. David Blower is. Pardon me.
All right.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Can I make one further remark in response?
Yeah, please do.
I think this is the moment to mention the role that Ivan Illich assigned to humor, and not in a trivial sense, but in a deep sense. So he says that he feels he's understood a passage in the gospel only after he's begun to smile.
Yeah.
He compares understanding the gospel to getting a joke. These were not idle remarks. He similarly, in a piece I reread recently, which was, I think, someone from a Jesuit mission journal came and interviewed him in Cuernavaca. This would have been around 67. And he's at pains to try and tell the interviewer that they're not trying to do something. They're trying to be something. They're trying to create an atmosphere, a sense of humor, of a feeling. And so at the end of my long tome about Illich that was published a couple of years ago, I came to the conclusion that a central feature of his thought for me was what I call complementarity. It's not a term that's very familiar. It's not a term I'm very happy with. I'd appreciate advice about it, but that he saw that he never conceived anything without conceiving its complement, its other side. So, and humor is what pays tribute to the fact that we'll never get out of this world alive, as Hank Williams says. We're stuck in these things. We're going to love people we disagree with, and how are we going to deal with that? And on and on and on, because we're always in contradictory situations. We are ourselves embodied contradictions. The words we use are all contradictory. The world is made, in my opinion, of contradiction, and the cross represents contradiction in that sense, for me. So there are so many things that we can't get out of, but we can dispose ourselves towards them in a light, kind, and humorous fashion. Here endeth the lesson. Thank you, David.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Sam. We've come to the point in the discussion where we would like to open it up to anybody who has questions or thoughts they'd like to put into the dialogue. I think we've been too gripped by the conversation for any of us to bother writing anything in the chat. So I don't know what thoughts are on the table. I'm going to allow anyone who wishes to just wave their hand if you have a question you'd like to throw into the room. If nobody does, I'll begin, but I would rather hear from somebody else in the room.
Marcus is good at impossible to answer questions.
If you wave and I don't see you, please just keep doing it, because I'm sort of scrolling up and down the room.
I know there are people in the room who live these things thoughtfully and with a lot of curiosity and with a lot of integrity. So I'm also looking forward to questions from the room.
Well, okay. Elias Krim, I see you waving. So would you like to throw a question in?
Go on, Elias.
Sure. Hi, Sam.
Hey, it's good to see you, pal.
Good to see you. Sam and I are quietly trying to stir the pot in various ways, different ways, with a hope, I guess, maybe, of kind of a recurrence of Illich in the public conversation as best we can give it a push. And I think you could argue there might be different places to push. Many of you probably know who David Bollier is. And David Bollier works with the movement around the commons. And that's certainly a very Illichian area of activity. The COVID reminded us of this great work on the medical establishment. I happen to come out of a Catholic background, and I'm hoping to publish an article on the ways in which Illich and his themes in many ways kind of prefigures where Pope Francis is at the moment among Catholic circles. Not that many in Catholic circles, as far as I can tell, have ever heard of Illich, or not in a long time. I just wondered who in the group might have some thoughts on where does Illich seem most relevant right now? That, you know, maybe it's not so obvious, but where in your experience and your reflection, does he seem to be speaking most clearly? I would just be curious to know, because I think we might have different angles, of course, on him. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I have some, but perhaps others would like to speak.
I would love to hear your thoughts, David. But before you do, can I just suggest that if you have thoughts, you're welcome to say them, but you can also type them down if there are many different thoughts on this in the room. Then it'd be fascinating to have a written list of where this is pointing to people. So I'll hand back over to you, David Cayley, in what you're about to say.
Well, first, Elias, greetings. I'm glad to get a glimpse of you, at least virtually. And I think there are 1,000 answers to your question, because there, I mentioned science, I mentioned language. I think there are many other points. But what preoccupies me is that even in The Rivers North of the Future, which began as 2 weeks of radio interviews and produced a 5-hour radio broadcast in Canada called The Corruption of Christianity, laid out something that he called a hypothesis, and was insistent that it deserved that hypo. It was less than a thesis. It was a sketch, he said. It was a study program. So he didn't claim confidently or decisively that corruptio optimi pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst, summed up the history of the West. But he gave it as his opinion, his intuition, and his hypothesis to be studied. Now, I think that that hypothesis, that there is something in the genetic structure, if I can use that metaphor, I don't mean it literally, of the Western and now through its sequels, worldwide society, is in fact Christian. That his statement that this is paradoxically the most Christian society, the one that conceives itself as post-Christian, is indeed the case, then I think that leads into many fruitful byways. One of them is the reconceptualization of religion, not as an identification and an identity, but as Karl Barth says, yoke. And I think the term is good. It's a burden that we bear, a destiny that we cannot escape. I think it's a very fruitful avenue and will shed light on many aspects of our current reality. But I don't see a lot of people who are actually taking him up on his invitation to carry out this study. So that would be my remark about where he's relevant right now.
If I just add to that, one area in terms of my paid work, I find that Illich, my paid work, I work I do different contracts, but they're all around, my job title is a green connector. So I work in the neighborhood. Imagine if a kind of community organizer and a gardener a hybrid role of that. So my title is actually Green Connector. It's what I do for a lot of my paid work. But it is about connecting residents, neighbors to one another to care for green spaces. Now, what's interesting to me is both organizations, Companions for Hope, and there's another Christian community development organization called Open Door. They work with what's called an ABCD framework. ABCD is short for asset-based community development. So asset-based is a counterpoint to what might be deficit-based. So often in institutional language and institutional imagination, you have a deficit mindset where you only look at the needs or what's lacking in a community, and then social workers and others kind of fill in what's lacking in the community. Now, what's interesting to me is that Illich's emphasis on trying to recover verbs, agency, presence, all of this, I mean, how resonant it is with ABCD. In fact, you could, I think it was John McKnight who might have either coined or developed this idea in the States, who John McKnight was a close friend of Illich and wrote a book called The Abundant Community and was trying to move us in that direction. So the way I talk about it, and one of the ways it's been introduced to me that I think resonates deeply with Illich, is yes, my neighborhood, there are things that are broken. There are things that need attention. And there are things, for example, fire service or NHS, that might need an institutional response that neighbors aren't going to organize on their own. But the ABCD is about starting with what's strong to address what's wrong. And I think there's an aspect there in the neighborhood and kind of civic space to reimagine how we find a language to name and organize our assets instead of just focusing on what's wrong or not there. And I wonder if that might resonate with anyone else on the call in their work. I think Paul Eade might be here, and I know that he's conversant with that. But again, it's just to trying to get that imagination to where it's not rose-tinted glasses, but it's a different lens to talk about what's at hand and what we can do with that.
There is a question in the chat from Lydia Cattrell, my partner Lydia Cattrell. So bear with me. I'm going to read this question out. I'm interested in what white coat knowledge Sam and David have found it most challenging to put down and what helped them to do so.
Wow. Well, Sam just spoke, so I guess I'm on the hook to try and answer that. I would say I probably mentioned the two themes already that where I am most engaged in trying to, as you say, put down white coat knowledge. Before I left the CBC radio program Ideas, where I worked for many, many years, I perpetrated a 24-hour radio series called How to Think About Science, which we talked about last time because it had some influence on Dougald Hahn, I was happy to know. But that wrestles with the question of how to get to grips with the pretensions of science and to balance it against people's practical judgment, people's ability to think for themselves, and so on. I would say my second preoccupation is the care and feeding of language and words. It's always been my preoccupation, and it was what I did at the CBC, and I think it should be part of what the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation does, and it generally speaking isn't. So those would be my two answers.
Yeah, it's really good. Great question, Lydia. I think it's really interesting because I think so much of my formal academic training is in theology, and I ended up going on to do a PhD in theology. And Yeah, it's hard to go through that without being socialized to think that the pressure there is you doing academic research almost forces you to into that expert, you know, you become an expert on writing text about other people's text. I mean, I think is you know, kind of how, in fact, PhD research by definition is you're filling in a gap. So the more niche, the better. And I think, you know, even in the way one of the real gifts, I think, of kind of going through that process and coming out on the other side, and is trying to also reimagine a way to do theology. So I think the white coat version of theology is that you kind of hide behind jargon and a certain kind of discourse that just talks about other people's texts and what you read. Of course, you can learn from that. I think what I got from Illich and was trying to, again, reimagine theology as responses to encounters, and allowing the encounters, those contingent moments of encountering the other, to be the point at which theology, that's what you're doing theological reflection because of that and in light of that. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question exactly, but I guess it's just trying to, so much of what Illich himself wrote was out of conversations and friendships. And I think the white coat mentality, there is a kind of way in which you're conditioned to hide behind a certain way of talking, where I think there is another way that I'm leaning into, which is trying to allow friendships and encounters to even shape the questions and the inquiry.
I think we possibly have time for one more question.
If no one's throwing in a question, I can just throw in something to the question about like where people are finding Illich most relevant. Illich was pivotal in pushing me out of therapy for a time, of kind of repentance in the wilderness of a professionalized identity, and has come with me back in as I've recently been certified as a professional marriage and family therapist again. And the living inside of a different kind of Christianity really helped me see how much the structures of my school were like structures of the church, the sense of a doctrine, a kind of special knowledge that has to be transmitted a certain kind of way with certain kinds of authorities. And then you get this, you go through this special process of induction that certifies you, much the way the priest is set aside as someone with a special trust. And especially I've been thinking about, you know, Illich talks about the way in which the invention of the role of the priest as confessor, mm-hmm. as a kind of institutional professional version of what was a natural friendship-based sense in the Christian community of, it's good to have a soul friend, someone you can really talk to about what's on your heart, to institutionalizing that to something that's obligatory and something that a good, responsible person should do on a regular basis to kind of keep their plate clean, you know, how much that's transferred into therapy land. And how much the therapist has become that professional confessor. And so I sit in that role now with a sense of the beauty of the special connections I can facilitate, but also the shadow of how easily I can be co-opted into pulling energy and attention away from natural relationships. Every time you're coming to see me as your therapist is a time you're not sitting down with your beloved auntie or your dear friend who knows you so well, and to constantly remember that's where I'm hoping people to end up. That's what I, you know, to make them permanent clients is deeply parasitic. And Illich Illich has a way of naming that for me that kind of x-rays me. I love that frame of the x-ray, Sam. So that's a place where, just in terms of where I am in my life right now, that's where it's touching me most directly.
Can I follow on from that, David, or do you?
Yes, you're welcome to. Yeah, please do.
I think, you know, Marcus, that comes close to what I was trying to say earlier about critical thinking. I think there are, Ivan famously made a distinction in an interview he did with for the New Yorker in 1970 between the church as she and the church as it. Well, he made that distinction in many ways in relation to many things. But the point is, I think that the church and she and the church as it don't come in two separate packages. You know, they're the same church. Another story about him, which is maybe germane and was important to me, was that when he went to Puerto Rico, still quite a young man, in 1956, and became a high functionary of the university, he was vice rector and often acting rector of the Catholic University at Ponce, he wouldn't celebrate Mass. He got a little hut that he bought way off on a distant coast and would sometimes say Mass because it pleased him to do so for a group of fishermen who wouldn't be able to find the university on the map. And but again, he made the know the difference is perhaps is how I would in one way summarize his thought. His counsel, if you like, know the difference. We stand in the midst of things, but we can stand back from them, even as we stand in the midst of them. Right? We can act within those circumstances in certain ways. Right? We can remember what we can't necessarily enact at a given moment, right? And that I think is a little bit what you're trying to say about the way you now practice therapy, right? Aware of what you're doing, right? Aware that you can't live on this earth and not cast a shadow, right? It's inherent. It's not just a mistake. So when you stop making mistakes, then you'll be perfect. You'll never be perfect.
Thank you. I will take that as an absolution offered to me by a friend and not a professional.
Which it is.
We have several questions from Robert about the Transition Town movement.
Yes, that's me. I spent a lot of time in the Transition Town movement. It strikes me that it should have been a natural fit for the insights and thoughts and sort of world view, as it were, of Illich. And I really have failed to find that happening. It's so strange. And we did a lot of work, community farms and repair cafes and it goes on, you know. I'd be really interested if somebody explained to me why it didn't become sort of de rigueur to read Illich when you were sort of getting involved with the Transition Town movement. Why did it not happen? That's my question.
I just wanted to say really briefly, Robert, I really appreciate that. And I do think that's something it would be really great to pick up with Dugald as well. I was just listening to a podcast that Dugald did. Perhaps we can share that. It was Rune Soup. It was a separate conversation.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Tasmanian guy.
Yeah. And
Gordon
and
White.
Listening to it this week. And it was, there was almost a throwaway line there that doesn't explain it, but I think it contextualized why. And he says, because he was making the comment that a lot of political public servants and politicians are like, Illich may be right, but what can I do with it? Like, I can't do anything with this. There's a certain radicality to it. And Dougal then, again, in almost in passing, but I want to bring this up with him next week. He said, but the reality is that people are only ready to hear Illich when they're already in the ruins. There's something about being in a space in which the structures and the expectations around the institutions and forms have failed or broken. And I do wonder if, you know, Rob Hopkins, there's so much resonance. You're absolutely right to hit that resonance. When Rob Hopkins talks about reskilling and all that, I immediately go to Illich and the recovery of verbs, convivial recovery. I mean, there's so much there. I do wonder, you know, the transition moment was around 2006 or mid 2000s, I recall. And I wonder, in a sense, if Rob's, you know, people weren't ready for Illich in 1971. Maybe they weren't ready for a lot of that transition in 2006. Yes, and there's a new moment to address.
Peak oil never happened, you see. Mm. Peak oil never happened. I mean, it is happening again, but it's not, it didn't happen then.
I would love, I really appreciate that question. And maybe to bring that back with Dougal's framing of the ruins, and people might relate to that in different ways, but I very much see us as that's the work that the likes of Illich, the likes of Rob Hopkins invite us to. So maybe that's something we can pick up next week as well, man.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, Sam, of something to bring forward. And I'm really appreciating the way, as this conversation is unfolding, it's putting its roots into the ground around us more and more. And I look forward to more of that. I want to say thank you so much, Sam. Thank you for the book. Thank you, Sam and David, for being willing to make time in whatever else you're carrying on this Sunday to share and invite us into a convivial conversation. It's been rich for me. I'm sure it's been rich for all of us. And I very much look forward to meeting again 2 weeks from now. That'll be November the 12th. Peace and all good.
Farewell, all. Sam, nice to see you.
Lovely to see you, David. Lovely.
Thanks, everybody. It's great.
I'm gonna begin us, unless there's any objections, Marcus. Should we begin?
Wait a minute. I haven't got my gear here.
Oh. There we go. We'll wait for David Kelly to get his
I thought this guy was a professional broadcaster. Boy.
I was. But I'm not anymore.
Getting sloppy, David.
Show business.
Now I'm just a forgetful old man.
A beloved. Forgetful
old
man.
All right, that's nice. I'll accept the correction. A beloved, forgetful old man.